President Barack Obama says in a June 24th town hall meeting on health care reform that he does not want to see bureaucracies making end-of-life decisions. Meanwhile, measures are being filed in Congress to address various aspects of end-of-life care. Hi, welcome to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, go to practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. Meyer Christopher joins us. She is the president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics. Also with us is Dr. Christian Sinclair of Kansas City Hospice. First, let's talk about what the president had to say last week. Myra, were you encouraged, discouraged, or neutral about what the president had to say about end-of-life care within the context of health care reform?
I'm very glad to hear President Obama talking about these issues. End-of-life care reform and health care reform are two different issues, two different matters. But when you look at the significance of end-of-life care in from a variety of perspectives, we think it's the keystone issue in health care reform. And not only because of the importance in the individual's life and because of the importance in the context of the family and the community, but also because of the tremendous economic impact that end-of-life care has.
Dr. Sinclair, your thoughts about the president's remarks?
Yes, both in the town hall meeting on TV recently, but also a piece in The New Yorker, he's frequently reflected back on the care that his grandmother received and the decision to do a hip replacement with someone who has a terminal cancer diagnosis, and the struggles that he went through in thinking, is this a good thing for her or not, relying on the doctor's advices and still realizing that overall it didn't necessarily come to the best intended outcome. And I think that's in reflecting what I see or hear in his words, is that trying to figure out what the outcome would be with the treatments that you choose, that's the struggle that all healthcare providers have, and to try and figure out how you legislate that better is the difficult part. And I think just the fact that he sees that as one of the prime difficulties of healthcare reform is encouraging.
Well, and earlier in his campaign, he also talked about the death of his mother from cancer. So this is a man who has had personal experience. He has watched his mother as a young woman die of a terminal cancer. And then he's also watched his grandmother, who is quite elderly, and he and his family members had difficult decisions to make. In addition, he is being advised by Zeke Emanuel, who was formerly the head of bioethics at NIH and who has now been seconded to OMB to be an advisor to President Obama about these issues. Dr. Emanuel has done a lot of writing about ethical issues around palliative care, end-of-life care. So this is a man who has experience, he has interest, and he is receiving advice from well-informed people. So we are in a different position as far as our president thinking about these matters.
End-of-life legislation is starting to make its way through Congress. And Dr. Sinclair, you mentioned how the difficulty probably becomes somewhat more difficult as we get into the legislature. In Congress, a number of bills have been filed on end-of-life care. Let's focus on two. First, the Senior Navigation and Planning Act of 2009 by Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. Among many things, this would expand Medicare hospice benefits, transitional care benefits, increasing that to 18 months, Dr. Sinclair.
I don't believe the full text of the bill has come out. I've only seen some summaries of it, but I think the discussion of expanding Medicare's hospice benefit, while idealistic, we still haven't maximized the use thus far of the 6 months. And we know that it's commonly quoted that we have a median stay in hospice in the sub-30-day range, usually around 20 days. So even though Medicare hospice benefit right now is really pegged at 6 months, we're using just one-sixth of it, if less than that. So what I have seen in some reviews or early reviews is possibly this 18-month period may include concurrent care of doing curative and palliative care. So not exactly a traditional hospice comfort-only approach. So until the full text comes out and we really understand what that concept is, that part's going to be interesting to see what they decide.
There's been talk for a long time about quote-unquote, open access models to hospice care, where it's not kind of an either-or, that either you have given up on all hopes of curative care and you opt for really quality end-of-life care. But in reality, many of us want access to both of those. And so, again, as Christian has indicated, we don't have the full text of the Warner bill yet, but we believe that that's what he is opting for. The other piece of legislation that is in Congress now that Senator Rockefeller, Jay Rockefeller, was the primary author of, although several others have signed on, is really more mature legislation. It's been introduced several times now. Senator Rockefeller has been interested in these matters for some time. He's been involved in discussions about this for a long time, as has Susan Collins from Maine, who's also a co-author on this. And it's much better understood and known at this point about what they're trying to do.
Well, financial incentives are a common theme in both of these bills. Are those important? Do you think that is something that will spur some action, Dr. Sinclair?
Well, I think in Senator Rockefeller's bill, the focus to put the resources, the financial resources, in building the foundation both of a workforce that can care and have the expertise to care well for patients in their last several months of life, but also putting in quality markers so that when we call something palliative care or hospice, that we really know what that is. Hospice has grown in service scope, but the research to back up the evidence of what hospice and palliative care does is lagging behind the clinical services. So putting in place good research infrastructure to really test and make sure what we see the benefit at the bedside really over a larger population makes the most sense.
Another aspect of the Warner bill, Myra, is related to providing better education on living wills, advanced directives, those kinds of things. And so we can always have better education on this issue, but whether or not that actually comes to the results that we want is another matter.
Well, actually, both pieces of legislation have components about that. And as you know, Laurel, and Christian, you know also, the center has been engaged for 25 years in educating people about the importance of advanced care planning, as have many other organizations. And in addition, the Rockefeller legislation says that they will provide reimbursement to professionals, to providers who engage in dialogue and conversation with people about these matters, because often we hear from physicians, Yeah, I know I need to do this, but, you know, we're so crunched for time now, and there's no reimbursement for it. Sometimes I actually wonder if that's not an excuse, if it's really not. The reality is really not that providers just aren't very comfortable with this.
Well, there are a lot of studies that back that up, aren't there?
There are. Mm-hmm. There are studies that providers aren't very comfortable in having these conversations. But we do know that financial incentives do make a difference. There are studies about that as well. So, you know, we hope that society is really moving towards a full understanding of how important education and dialogue and discourse and new ways of caring for people at the end of life, people with advanced illness. As you know, Laurel, I'm not sure, Christian, that you and I've had a chance to talk about this, but the Institute of Medicine has invited a group of people to come to D.C. and is starting a new initiative to develop a new model to empower patients and to improve care of people with advanced illness. So I think there are just a lot of signs that we are really maybe at the tipping point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of folks have spent a lot of time getting here, and I'm very hopeful about this.
Now, one of the things that was part of that report to Congress that the center was part of last week on advanced care planning and advanced directives, that there's a recognition that's increasing that effective advanced care planning and discernment of end-of-life care preferences is an ongoing process, that you just don't fill out a set of pieces of paper and feel like that the issue is resolved.
Right. You know, early on, and the center was guilty of this as well, we thought that we took a very legalistic approach to this, that if you just got people to fill out a document and sign it and get it notarized and get a gold seal on it, I used to say, that, boy, that was it. And frankly, the Patient Self-Determination Act that was passed in 1990 promoted that model. We thought success was measured by the number of documents that you actually got signed. But one of the things that the report that went to Congress last week that we worked on with Rand Health Institute indicates that that is not, that doesn't measure change in behavior for patients and their families or for providers. And it really, that model doesn't fit very well in the clinical environment.
And even if you do have the decisions made in place, oftentimes from a clinical perspective, I'm finding families are faced without the resources to support the decisions that they choose to have. For instance, frequently people quote that most people would like to die at home. Well, that's usually made when you're sitting around a table and everyone's doing fine in their health. But then when it's in the hospital and the family realizes this is a very sick person that I don't know if I can confidently and safely take care of at home, that decision to come home is not as well supported by our healthcare infrastructure. Even with hospice, as great service as it is, it's still most of the care is done by the family, or if they do have the financial resources, hired caregivers. So there is a little bit of a Swiss cheese of a net support the decisions that people say they would like to have.
There's often a big gap, I think, Christian, between, you know, we talk about the 30,000-foot level when policymakers are deciding how this ought to happen. Then when the, as I say, the sky hits the road, when families are really, really dealing with these matters, and there's so much intensity emotionally, but as you're pointing out, there are also real empirical matters about, can I do this? And then it becomes complex because, you know, their people are working, they have other obligations. So it's very, I think, challenging for us as individuals, as families, as people who live in community, but also as a society to work through these matters. But I, as I said, I think we're really doing the hard work and doing a better job of figuring it out.
Now the education, the lobbying, all starting to take place in earnest in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere across the country. What are your hopes on this, on how this will play out? And Myra, you kind of chuckled there a little bit.
Well,
but
go ahead. Because I was talking to a very high-level insurance executive the other day, and I won't mention a name, but he said...
Oh, we can probably guess, but go ahead.
Said, you know, boy, when we talk about this right now, this being end of life, we get a lot of attention on the Hill. And, you know, forever, the D word was like saying the F word. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just didn't say it. I mean, you just didn't talk about these issues. And the notion that this person now thinks it makes him popular in Congress to talk about this, I find quite amusing. But, again, it makes me quite hopeful.
Yeah. I'll tell you the thing I hope doesn't happen is actually that palliative care or end-of-life care becomes almost a just a buzzword, and then becomes almost negatively associated with government rationing of healthcare, or basically what happens when palliative care hospice isn't anymore about a choice, but it's just, it's your consolation prize. And if it somehow gets turned around and demonized, as buzzwords can happen to them, that's the thing I'm hope that doesn't happen, that this still stays at a very earnest conversation about real tough choices that people go through.
Well, Senator Warner, whenever he introduced this bill, did receive criticism that his provisions, our proposed provisions, would be aimed at saving money rather than providing good care at the end of a life.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the Star on Sunday, there was a wonderful article about Kansas City being perhaps better positioned than other communities about end-of-life care. But the real focus of the article was that we're not spending as much money on health care in Kansas City. And when I talked to the reporter, he kept asking me, aren't there lots of cost savings? Aren't there lots of cost savings? And I was very clear with him, saying what I want to talk about is appropriately expending the resources that we spend. And my interest is in really providing quality care and care that's consistent, congruent with people's goals and values. And I agree with you, Christian. This is not about trying to save money on the backs of dying people. Mm-hmm. This is about trying to distribute our resources in the best way possible. Now, there are some studies that indicate that it may also be very prudent. Right. You know, that there may actually be, it may be a wise way to spend our resources. But I agree with you entirely that if we pervert this, we will all lose in the long run.
Myra Christopher is president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics. Christian Sinclair is a physician with Kansas City Hospice. You've been listening to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information, visit the center's website at practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. I'm your host, Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.